This is an audio presentation of Systematic Theology 3, 3153, Unit 1, entitled, How the Modern World Thinks. This is Dr. Charles Farrar. To give you an idea of some of the concepts that you may want to hold at the end of the lecture, we will review briefly how people used to think. When I use the term unity of knowledge, that means that people felt all knowledge could be unified under one philosophical system. Then we will cover Reformation distinctives. We will call Scripture's contributions to knowledge. And we will mention some early Christian scientists who made a difference between naturalistic and natural science. We will trace a little bit of the idea of freedom in Kant and Rousseau, and then point out briefly the deterministic stance of modern science. We will use a phrase from Francis Schaeffer on modern morality and define that and how it has influenced modern thinking. We will briefly dwell on Kierkegaard's contribution, that is Kierkegaard, and discuss a little of the upper story experiences men are now seeking, such as Aldous Huxley, who speaks of a first-order experience, where modern linguistic analysis in philosophy has influenced modern behavior, what happens when faith is pitted against reason, and why Christianity is capable of saving us from despair. Now, the origin of modern man really goes back to Aquinas, who opened the way for a discussion between nature and grace. Aquinas had received the new Aristotle, which was discovered in 1204, and from his day on, philosophers were constantly struggling to find a way to unify nature and grace. Nature, of course, represents the world as we see it. Grace, the world which God gives to man in his fallen condition. And they tried to find some kind of rationality that would say something about both nature and grace and hold these two together. So up to this time, all philosophers had really struggled with three major fields. First, they were rationalistic. By this, we simply mean man begins from himself. He begins to gather ideas about himself. He gathers information concerning particulars, and from this forms ideas of universals. Secondly, all believed in the rational. That is, they believed in the validity of reason. If one thing were true, then the opposite could not by its nature be true. Therefore, the basis of classical logic was simply that A is not non-A. And thirdly, men were always looking for something in the field of philosophy that would unite all known knowledge. They hoped by means of rationalism plus reason to find an answer that would include all of life. And this is the realm that Aquinas characterized as the realm between nature and grace. Now, in Aquinas' view, the will of man was fallen, but the intellect was not. Man's intellect became autonomous. In this realm, man was independent. And that is, in fact, an error or a near error of modern fundamentalism, which assumes that the will is impaired, but that the intellect is still continuous with both the Christian and the non-Christian. It does not really take the fall seriously enough. And as soon as the autonomy of human reason is set up, then man can take off with no real relationship to the Scriptures. By the way, Many of the ideas in this lecture originate in Francis Schaeffer's good book, Escape from Reason. Now, the painters and the writers called on this idea of the autonomy of reason, that is, reason floats free from the grace of God, just as sort of man's natural inheritance. And such men as Cimabue, Dante, and others saw nature taking over the realm of grace. Now, this is always the tendency of philosophy, that nature swallows up grace. One of the greatest men in this development was Leonardo da Vinci, who lived 1352 to 1519, and if you look at his life, it actually overlaps the first part of the Reformation. He is the closest to what we would call a modern man up to his time. And it was da Vinci's idea that in the realm of universals, grace was present, and in the realm of nature, we only saw particulars. It followed, of course, a kind of classic Neoplatonism. Now let's look for a moment at Reformation distinctives and how that influenced this idea of thinking in man. John Calvin was born in 1509. His Institutes were written in 1536, and Da Vinci had died in 1519, which is right in the center of this. So there was this overlap period of the Renaissance man, of whom Da Vinci is the outstanding example, and the Reformation man, with Calvin as a good example. To the problem of unity, the Reformation gave an entirely opposite answer from that of the Renaissance. They repudiated both Aristotle, that Aquinas had partially followed, and Neoplatonic presentations. According to the Reformation, the root of the trouble was the growing old humanism in the Roman Catholic Church and the doctrine of an incomplete fall. You remember Aquinas had taught that though the will was fallen, yet the intellect of man was free to choose. And the fact of the matter is that in theology, your anthropology determines a large part of your theology. That is, the way you think about man has a great deal to do with the way you think about God. Now, if you hold to a serious fall of man in his original state, you'll tend to be pessimistic about the nature of man, his innate goodness. But if you hold to a rather light view of the fall, that maybe man fell in his moral nature, or perhaps he fell in his will, but that his intellect continues in continuity with God, then you have tendencies which will lead you either into a Christian humanism or into an optimistic view of man. The Reformation accepted the biblical picture of a total fall. Man had fallen in every element of his being. Man had been born, had been created in the image of God, but now he is fallen, his whole man, his intellect, his emotions, his will, his body, and he's no longer able to do the good. Now, this is a very serious view of the nature of man. And in this area, the Reformation follows much more closely the teachings of Augustine than those of Aquinas. And we can see a direct lineal line from Paul to Augustine, to Luther, to Calvin. And certain things follow from this. First, there is nothing autonomous for man in the area of final authority. In other words, man is not capable of making final decisions without reference to God. The Reformation says that our final and sufficient source of knowledge is in Scripture. And so, there came the principle of sola, S-O-L-A, scriptura, so that the Reformation is against the autonomy of reason and stands for Scriptures alone. Secondly, there was no idea of man being autonomous in the area of salvation. In the Roman Catholic position, there was a divided work of salvation. But the Reformation said, no, it is sola gratia, that is, only by grace. Christ died for our salvation, and he alone. But in Roman Catholicism, it was synergistic, synergistic, that is, God and man working together. And in it, there was the idea of man working in some part for his salvation. And you see this humanistic element which is involved. The Reformers say man can do nothing. There is nothing he can do to save himself. He is saved only on the basis of the finished work of Christ, as Jesus died in time and space. And this was the second great Reformation principle. The third was sola fides, F-I-D-E-S, only by faith. So in the area of authority, scriptures stand supreme. In the area of salvation, faith stands supreme. And in the area of cooperation, grace stands supreme. So in either of these areas, there's no division between what the church or natural theology would say and what the Bible would say. There was no division in the work of salvation. It was scripture alone, faith alone, grace alone, and here, of course, the heavy weight rests on the sovereignty of God. Now, according to the Reformation, scripture gives us keys to two kinds of knowledge. First, the knowledge of God, and second, the knowledge of God's relations with men in nature. From the scriptures, we can know something true about God, something true about man. And in order to distinguish between relative and absolute truth, Schaeffer uses the interesting statement, true truth. So from now on, whenever we use the phrase true truth, it will refer to what God says and is equated with absolute truth. From the Reformation, we learn that man has value. Man has value because he was made originally in the image of God. And man's problem is precisely this. Why is he so wonderful and yet so diabolical? Who is he? How is it that he can soar to the heavens and at times seem a little lower than the angels, and another time descend to the demons? The Reformation gave us the classical biblical answer that this occurred because of the fall, that this fall occurred in history, and that the only man we now have to deal with is a man in revolt. While man is morally guilty before God, he is still not a worm. He is still not nothing. He is something, always, because he is made in God's image. In other words, if we can think of a diagram in which there is grace in the upper story and nature in the lower story, or simply draw a line with grace above, nature beneath, in the upper story we may speak of a true revelation concerning God. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And this revelation informs our understanding of nature. It tells us what the cosmos is like. So there was a real unity of knowledge. God, by revelation, told us what nature was for. He told us what man was for. And there was a unity of both nature and grace. Now look, if you remember, in humanism, nature floats autonomously free. It doesn't owe any fealty to God. It's simply there. But the Reformation would not allow any autonomous portion to exist. Everything was under the sovereignty of God. Man enjoyed no autonomy apart from God. Well, what then happens to freedom? One of the major concerns of all men has always been freedom. The biblical position is clear. Man cannot be explained as totally determined and conditioned because he's made in the image of God. He has freedom in himself. He is an unprogrammed man. He is a significant man. He lives in a significant history, and he can change history. But it's also true that he's in revolt. His freedom gives him that opportunity. Christ died in substitution for the sins of man, but man was given the choice of whether or not he would accept what God had done. Now, the Bible teaches us that God is a living being, a living God. Everything starts and flows from God. And that's why we cannot solve the problem of the unity of knowledge by starting with man, that is, anthropologically. We have to start with God. We must have a theological orientation. The Christian God is not an impersonal deity floating out there nowhere, but he's a personal God, an infinite God. Now, sometimes in philosophy, men will say God is personal, but he's not infinite. Or others may say, well, he's infinite, but he's impersonal, as in the Eastern religions. But Christianity is unique because it says God is both personal and infinite. When you come to man's personality, the chasm between infinity and God disappears. We have a personal, infinite God, and we have man and God sharing alike in personality. That's what we mean when we say man is made in the image of God. He shares God's personality. Now, we also note that there's an infinite chasm between man and his nearest animal. The Bible sees man's relationship as going upward, not downward. Modern man tends to see man's relationship as going downward to the animal or even to the machine. The Bible always rejects this view. You are related to God. It's true. You are not infinite, but finite, but you are truly personal. You are created in the image of a personal God who exists. Now, the biblical view opposes the Platonic view in that it does not elevate the body above the soul, but it says that the whole man is important. The biblical view emphasizes the fact that the whole man belongs to God, while Plato said the soul, the upper man, that's what's important. The body, the lower man, that has little importance at all. And throughout all Greek philosophy, you run into this problem of them not paying very much attention to the body. The biblical view also opposes the idea of humanism, where the body and autonomous mind of man become important. Grace becomes very unimportant in this view. The biblical view says neither the Platonic nor the humanist view will do. First, God made the whole man, and he is interested in the whole man. Secondly, the fall affected the whole man, his mind as well as his moral nature. Third, Christ's work means redemption for the whole man. Does that sound familiar? That is, Christ's redemption means healing for the spirit, healing for the mind, and healing for the body. So the real lordship of Christ can dominate the whole man. Now, perhaps the spirit-filled man comes closer to the pre-fall man of any individual, for his life is being healed by the Spirit. Watchman Nee has an interesting book called The Latent Powers of the Soul, in which he describes Adam as an absolutely fantastically heroic genius who had powers that we can only guess at. I suspect there's a point of truth here. But the spirit-filled man is on his road back to restoration, to be what God intended man to be at the beginning. So the Reformation really meant a reassertion of the lordship of Christ. Nothing is apart from Christ's lordship. God's interest is the whole man. Man has no autonomy apart from God. Now, what is perhaps not appreciated as much as it should be is the fact that modern science was very much involved in the situation outlined. For example, J. Robert Oppenheimer, although not a Christian, said that Christianity was needed to give birth to a modern science for the simple reason that Christianity created a climate of thought which put men in a position able to investigate this kind of universe. And one of the very great and early Christian scientists was Francis Bacon, who wrote in Novum Organum Scientiarum, "Man, by the fall, fell at the same time from the state of innocence and from his dominion over nature." Both of these losses, however, can even in this life be in some way repaired, the former by religion and faith, the latter by the arts and sciences. You see, Bacon was saying we've got two areas to our lives. There's the area which science speaks of, and that's the realm of nature, but there's an area for faith, and that speaks to the spirit of man. So, to Bacon, science and art are also under the province of God. He didn't see science as autonomous, a floating there away from God. But in this particular idea, science and art are free and intensified before both men and God. Early scientists also took from Christianity the belief that there was a reasonable God who had created a reasonable universe, and therefore man, by use of reason, could find out the universe's forms. For example, if I raise this pen and drop it 10 times, on the 8th time, it splinters off to the right. On the 9th time, it splits to the top. On the 10th time, it goes off to the left. What scientific law could you come up with? None at all, right? Because that would be an unreasonable course of action for a pen to take. So Christianity said we live in a reasonable universe because God is a God of reason. Now, without this basic understanding, science is impossible. For example, if I should put together certain elements, and at one time, these elements turn extremely cold. At another time, they turn extremely hot with no understanding of why or where. No science would be possible because that very element that I mixed together could destroy rather than be serviceable to men. Now, today the difference is that science is naturalistic. That is, it says there is nothing beyond nature. For though it held to the uniformity of natural causes, it did not conceive of God and man as being caught up in that machinery. Now, since the fall, man has always been trying to float some autonomy for himself. For example, Kant and Rousseau felt that freedom was beginning to be lost, so they wanted to put freedom in an autonomous position. Where grace once was, there they put freedom. The individual, for them, was the center of the universe. It's a freedom without restraint. Now, here is a significant change. Remember, we said that there were three things about philosophy from the time of the Greeks on. Remember, first we said they were rationalistic. That is, they thought that man could start from himself and reason to answers. And secondly, they believed in the rational. That is, they believed that this was a universe in which reason prevailed. And thirdly, they kept looking for some way of hanging it all together, of making it be constructed as one unified field of knowledge. And you remember, even at the time of Immanuel Kant, men were still tenaciously hanging to this hope. Can we find some idea? Can we find some philosophy which will make everything hang together? And rationalism is defined by the dictionary as a reliance on reason as the basis for the establishment of religious truth. Reliance on reason for the basis of establishment of religious truth. You see, that is counter to the Reformation, which said we receive that by a revelation in the scriptures. 2, a theory that reason in itself was a source of knowledge superior to and independent of sense perceptions. That is, that when you think with your mind, it's really a better way of arriving at knowledge than inspecting it from your senses, your smell, your taste, your sight. And three, a view that reason and experience, rather than non-rational elements, are the fundamental criteria in the solution of problems. What's that mean? You don't need God. You don't need miracles. You don't need the mysterious. In fact, you don't need religion, because reason and experience give you what you need to know. So here you see, rationalism believes it can find the final answers to the problems of man without God's help. What did the Reformation say? It said nonsense. Because of the fall, man's reason was impaired, and so it was an impossibility. In other words, using again Schaeffer's words, all true knowledge must originate from and in God. But when men precluded this, then modern science came. Because today, science believes in a closed system. What do we mean by that? We mean that the uniformity of natural causes in a closed universe is the dominant philosophy among scientists. That is, no miracle can occur, no extraordinary work of God, because the world by its nature precludes this. So for every miracle, there has to be some natural explanation. What that really does then is that puts God outside. God isn't around anymore. And man then becomes a machine who is ruled by a sphere of physics. The machine programs it all out. Now, this is why we call it deterministic and mechanistic, that it is predetermined by nature. Mechanistic, we mean that all you have is particulars, and therefore you're left with the mechanics. So in this case, that upper story that we wanted to save for grace, for the mysterious, for religion, is all swallowed up with mechanics. And in this case, the upstairs is gone. There's nothing left upstairs for men. There's nothing of the transcendental or the mysterious. The downstairs has eaten everything up. God isn't there. Freedom isn't there. Man is a machine. And this is the shifting of emphasis from a uniformity of natural causes to the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. Do you see that difference? You see? A Christian believes in the uniformity of natural causes, but he refuses to believe in a uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, because every closed system precludes God. Now, in a moment of summary, we have mentioned how the modern world thinks and how early philosophers had held to the fact that there were three things which, to them at least, appeared to be self-evident. First, rationalism. Secondly, that they lived in a reasonable universe. And thirdly, that there was a unified world of knowledge. We saw that Calvin came along, and in the Reformation thinking, he said God was sovereign over all. And there were three principles which were developed in the Reformation. You recall, sola scriptura, sola gratia, and sola fides. The scriptures then give us true knowledge of God and true knowledge of God's relations with nature. But we have a problem with man. Why is he in his dilemma? The scriptures teach us this is because of the fall, which affects the whole man, and that the job of regeneration is to renew man in the whole man. We distinguished also between early scientists who believed in a natural universe, but did not believe that that natural universe precluded Christ, and the natural universe of today, where people believe a closed system exists. closed system exists. In the next lecture, we shall go on with an understanding of modern man. This has been an audio presentation of Systematic Theology 3153, Unit 1. This is the end of the tape.